You're listening to the KunstlerCast featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of Too Much Magic, The Long Emergency, and The World Made by Hand novels.
Hello and welcome to the KunstlerCast. Thanks for dropping in. Pretty exciting week out there in the world of real-time events. Things are getting kind of spooky, actually. Syria is on everybody's mind, especially our friends in the U.S. government. They drew a line in the sand, quote, and President al-Assad of Syria apparently crossed it by gassing his own citizens in the political opposition. So now we have to supposedly go over and spank him, and nobody knows what the consequences of that will be. But it's a good bet that they won't be great consequences, and it's a good bet that we won't make friends by doing it. I believe in the analysis that our interests are far better served by staying out of Syria, and that the best outcome would be for President Assad and his adversaries, who are probably jihadis of one flavor or another, to reach a stalemate and wear each other out. In any case, it will probably be more destabilizing to the region and perhaps beyond the region if the USA and its European allies butt in. I'm famously allergic to conspiracy ideas, and I'm averse to ascribing all-out cynicism to our political leaders. But there's a lot to wonder about when you see the president of the U.S. and other people in the government beating the war drums at the exact moment that a pretty bad storm is developing in the global banking and finance horizon. Things are getting a little unglued out there, with several Asian currencies tanking and interest rates rising on the crucial U.S. 10-year bond, and gold reflecting nervousness and uncertainty by rising substantially in the last couple of weeks, and markets shuddering over a lot of loose taper talk. And we enter the fall of 2013 with a lot to worry about. So in light of all this, it's a happy coincidence to have Michael Clare as my guest on the podcast this week. Michael Clare is an internationalist, and he's the author of most recently, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, and many other books, including Blood and Oil and Resource Wars. He's also the professor of peace and world security studies at a five-college complex in Western Massachusetts, headquartered at Hampshire College, but a program that is also serving Smith College, the University of Massachusetts, Mount Holyoke, and Amherst. So here's my conversation with Michael Clare. I want to begin by asking you something that people ask me a lot, which is, considering all the stress points around the world in the form of resource scarcities and population overshoot and banking trouble and mischief and religious and political conflict, isn't it odd that nothing has snapped into a full-blown crisis in the last decade?
That's, of course, a good question. And, you know, some people would say, well, we do see signs of stress everywhere happening, economic slowdown, economic crisis, the Arab Spring, the civil war in Syria. You could say that these are all manifestations of a deeper crisis. But I do get your point that in comparison to what some of us have been saying about much larger scale catastrophe, we haven't seen that. And I think the reason is that the global economic system has become very powerful and very resilient and is able to compensate for slowdowns or setbacks in one area by building up its strength in another area. And an example of that I'll give, because it's very much on my mind, is the development of unconventional oil and gas supplies in North America, which nobody anticipated 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And it has had a dramatic shift in the world energy equation and given a big boost to American power that nobody anticipated. So there's a certain amount of resilience in the system that we have to make allowances for.
Nicole Foss, who is an economics and financial commentator, and a lot of other people, including myself, maintain that the shale oil phenomenon is a kind of Ponzi scheme that will have a much more limited life than a lot of promoters would imagine.
Now, that's another question that is of great interest, and I've looked into that as much as I can, and I'm impressed by a number of factors. One of them is the immense scale of the available resources. They're finding more and more every day. So there's a huge amount of unconventional fossil fuels and carbon that await development. And it's clear that the corporate world and the big banks and the investment houses and governments, everybody wants to get in on the act and is pouring a lot of money into this to see that it takes off. And in my mind, the limiting factor here is not the extent of the resources or the money. The limiting factor is that all of this is going to accelerate the process of climate change, and eventually people are going to put a stop to it. But I don't think that we should see this as a fly-by-night phenomenon. I think it is likely to persist.
Well, I think it's precisely Nicole Foss's point, and the point of a lot of other people, actually, that the advanced economies of our time really cannot endure a price of oil that is much above $100 a barrel, and that, in fact, there's a relation between the problems of capital formation and our future inability to actually develop the resources that you're touting.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. But what I see is that just mammoth amounts of money are being devoted to the development of these resources because they see a future for them, not necessarily in the West, but for sale to Europe, to Asia, to India, to developing economies, that there is a sufficient expectation of return that enormous amounts of money are going into this. And I think we're going to see that for a while. Now, this money will be taken away from other things like investment in renewable energy and other things that we might consider essential.
Rune Lichtvern, formerly one of the writers on the Oil Drum website, which discontinued a few weeks ago, made the point recently that the net capital losses for the shale oil industry were $14 billion this year.
I don't think that we should put too much emphasis on that because the amount of investment that's going in, and it's very hard to figure out what's included where, but I see reading the industry press great enthusiasm and optimism about the future of these resources. And it's not just American companies that are pouring money into it. It's Chinese companies and European companies because they want to be able to acquire the expertise to do this elsewhere. So now, in a sense, there's a Ponzi scheme at work because a lot of smaller producers are being bought up by the big ones. They have to borrow money to do that. And so we have to be cautious about all of this.
Well,
there
would be a lot of people who would say that the information, the so-called information coming out of the industry itself, is largely wishful and is largely hype and propaganda. For example, the notion that we're going to become Saudi America or that we're going to become energy independent.
Yeah, I agree that there's probably a lot of hype, but I also read the studies of the International Energy Agency, and they look pretty closely at all of this, and they're not in for it, for their own benefit in a sense. They're not a corporate arm; they're a governmental arm, and I'm following kind of their analysis that these unconventional fuels are here and are going to play a, they're going to replace conventional oil. And that's part of the story here as well, that a lot of companies are going to invest in unconventional energy, even if they don't make a lot of money on it, because their conventional resources are disappearing. And if they're going to remain in business, they're going to have some source of material, of new raw materials. And they can't get it expecting they're going to find new oil fields in Texas and Oklahoma. Those are now exhausted. So they have to go to these, to the Arctic and other places to perpetuate the oil age. And that has the backing of most governments in the world. And so until there's a policy shift, the process will move on.
Well, a lot of what you're saying about the behavior of governments, and especially their policies and their public utterances, gives off the odor of desperation.
You know, you're probably right about that. And that's a perfectly valid way of looking at this.
Well, to look at it another way, let me run something else by you. As a matter of policy, which we can describe as agreed upon group action, don't we seem to be running a campaign to sustain the unsustainable?
Oh, yes, I would think that's a very good way of describing what's happening.
I mean, we have certain choices. We could, for example, we could recognize that the living arrangement that we've developed in the USA probably doesn't have a bright future, and that we ought to live in another way and do other things and get away from happy motoring and rebuild the conventional railroad system because we're too broke to build a high-speed system. And we're not doing any of these things.
Right. Well, a few comments about that. I think we're all in agreement that this whole system, this economic model we have, energy-intensive, resource-intensive energy model, is unsustainable over the long run and, in fact, catastrophic. That's certainly what I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how much longer can it persist and how much more damage will it produce and inflict on us in the meantime? And 25 more years of this will be catastrophic. But I think it's conceivable that this system that you describe can persist for 25 more years. I don't think it's an imminent risk of collapse and disintegration. I think there are tremendous forces behind perpetuating this unsustainable, destructive way of life we have.
Well, the banking system, for one thing, at least on the grand scale, seems to be running on the fumes of accounting fraud and little else. And I would include in that central bank interventions in markets and the bond and interest rate rackets that are going on and the derivative games that are going on and especially the misreporting of data. And in that, I would probably include groups like the IEA, which have been criticized a lot for making bad guesses about the future.
What I do see, to balance that out, is I think there's a whole lot of economic activity which is going on, which is not part of this normal accounting. For instance, China and India and Russia are putting vast resources into the development of their domestic energy, coal and natural gas, and more of this is going to be unconventional forms of energy because that's where the future is. If for Russia to remain a great energy power, it has to exploit the Arctic. So they're going to put resources into this, whether it ever shows up in the banking statistics or not.
Where do you think the shakiest fault lines in the world are today? And what's going on in them?
Yeah. Now, that is a very interesting question, which we'd love to talk about at length.
Go ahead.
You know, so one that pops into mind is, China's ability to keep chugging along, even at reduced rate of growth from what it enjoyed in the past quarter century of 10% or so, even at a lower rate of growth, I have a lot of questions about whether China can continue to bolster its economy year after year after year. And any slowdown in its ability to expand the economy will have powerful ripple effects. We could see tremendous social unrest in China, kind of breakup of the country into regional warlordism, and environmental catastrophes as a result of that on a very large scale, or associated with that on a very large scale. So I see China's, we all talk about rising China and China's power, but we also have to look at the cracks in the Chinese economic system and their potential for collapse and chaos. That would be a start.
Well, in our lifetimes, in both of our lifetimes, we saw China become pretty psychotic at least once. And that was back in 1965 and 6 when Mao's Cultural Revolution was undertaken.
Well, now I think these are very good analogies. And not to mention that one, throughout Chinese history, going back centuries, millennia, there's a pattern of the concentration and centralization of power in a central state headed by an emperor and a very dominant bureaucratic system that succeeds for X number of years or centuries and then completely disintegrates. So there are many precedents for what I would picture in the future of some kind of breakdown in the Chinese system. So I think it's very reasonable. You ask what are some of the biggest threats to world stability? I'm not saying this is inevitable, but I do think this. I would put that on the top of the list of potential threats to world stability.
There are rumors that I see on the web, and you know we all know that the web is kind of unreliable that way. But there are rumors that King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia may actually not even still be alive. And even if he is, he is almost 90 years old. What happens with Saudi Arabia in the years ahead after Abdullah?
Certainly, the royal family is worried about this. They know it's going to come sooner or later, and they're running out of people from his generation. These are all the kings since Roosevelt met with King Abdul Aziz in 1945 and established the U.S.-Saudi relationship. Every king since then has been a son of Abdul Aziz and one of his many wives. Mm. Well, now that generation is not going to last much longer, and they're going to have to go down to the next generation, which is vast because all of these kings had many wives and spawned many princes. All of whom are competing for the top position when that day comes. And we could see fierce fighting, internal fighting within Saudi Arabia among various royal factions. And who knows where that might lead.
How important is the unrest in Egypt right now in the larger scheme of things?
The unrest in Egypt, in the larger scheme of things, I don't think it has quite the same geopolitical impact as some that arising somewhere else. But I do think it's significant in a sense of pointing out the growing weaknesses of the political institutions that have been created since World War II or since independence in many parts of the world. Where you've had a certain kind of state bureaucratic system that has perpetuated itself through repression and American military aid and so on, that shows signs of extreme distress. So Egypt could be a sign of what will happen throughout the world as a combination of the following, all of which go back to what you were asking me about earlier about the greatest threats to world stability. You know, it's declining resource availability, climate change, population growth, more and more young unemployed guys who are very bitter about their situation. You see that throughout the world, not just in Egypt. So how Egypt plays out will tell us a lot about what we may face in many other similar countries.
What do you think about when you reflect on the USA and the situation here with a shrinking and highly stressed middle class. And are you sometimes amazed that there hasn't been more political unrest here?
Oh, I'm totally amazed at the degree, at the lack of more unrest in the United States. It's quite surprising to me that that's the case. I think what I would say, what makes the United States a little bit more resilient than some other countries, there still is a certain degree of mobility. You can move here through with documents or without documents. You can come to this country, and if you choose to, find a way to make a living and start a little business and contribute in some way to the arts or to technology, whatever. I think compared to other countries around the world, that the U.S. has much more flexibility that way, and that has contributed to its success compared to other places. But that's just an observation.
Europe is going through a crisis that is largely a crisis of money, sovereign debt, banking, but they also are kind of going through a stealth crisis of of what their future energy supply is going to be. And I would argue, actually, that the two questions are related. France has actually taken the position of banning fracking for shale. And there's quite a bit of shale rock around the city of Paris itself. Whereas the UK right now, just in the last few weeks, seems to be going whole hog for shale. What do you observe about the European situation?
Yeah, well, now that's obviously important to consider. And I think the picture is complex and diverse. But just coming back to what we were talking about a minute ago when I was talking about the United States, Europe strikes me as having much less resilience and capacity to change and accommodate new populations. So Europe seems much more static and stuck. And this, I think, will contribute to further economic malaise and conflict eventually.
You were just there. What was the demeanor of the people you were with?
You know, it's a little bit like going to New York City. If you go to the successful urban centers, Madrid, Paris, Berlin, you see signs of kind of economic prosperity. But you have to look beyond those places to the industrial suburbs that surround all of them, where most tourists don't go, to see an awful lot of whole vast suburbs that are that are half finished and will never be built again, and a lot of poverty, especially among immigrants. So there's a lot of signs, if you look for them, of economic unease. But you don't see that if you just go to the tourist spots in Paris and London and so on. Mm-hmm. You have to look for it.
Tom Friedman put across the idea that globalism was going to be more or less a permanent condition. At least I think that's how people construe it. And mm-hmm. my own view of that is that globalism is a transient set of economic relations and really just kind of an episode in human history. What's your view of that?
My view is somewhat different. What I see emerging is a kind of regionalism gaining strength. That globalism writ large, I agree with you, probably has a problematic future. But I see greater attempts, for example, in South America, with Brazil and Argentina and its neighbors, trying to develop more regional cooperation and economic collaboration. And you see that in other parts of the world. I think the U.S. is beginning to see the importance of relating to South America in a way and hasn't before. It's a kind of a Western Hemisphere bloc. And so I think blockism is what's in our future, if I could put it that way. Regional blocs developing that maybe work closer together amongst themselves, but the globalist project will slow down.
What do you think, what do you make of the leadership in the U.S. and the other powerful developed nations? And do you think that they are straining to conceal a lot of disturbing truth from their publics about the various predicaments that we face of resources, climate, and money?
Now, that's an interesting question about how they operate, you know. To what degree is the president or the prime minister being informed, and to what degree is he or she choosing to ignore that information out of political expediency? And I think that's the case.
For instance, you know, I found it very strange over the last several years that the former Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, would allow Barack Obama to go on television and tell people we had 100 years of shale gas. It's not true.
I think then you're pointing out what I'm saying. There are plenty of people in the bureaucracy in Washington, and for instance, in the National Intelligence Council, if you look at their reports on global trends for the future, which are public documents, they present a picture not too different from what you or I would say. So there are people who are seeing what's happening in the world. I think what President Obama is doing, like other leaders of the world, is choosing not to see it and to proceed on the basis of their next election and winning votes in Congress for this project and so on. It's the day-to-day politics are overtaking any ability to cope with these larger threats.
Do you think there's a tipping point for that, beyond which our government really gets us into trouble, mostly through inaction and inertia and lethargy?
Well, I think that's certainly the case with global climate change. We see, a lot of talk coming out of the White House, and I don't want to demean the good things that they're doing, but the scale of the problem is so vast, and the need for radical change is so immense, and you don't see that any of the necessary steps are being taken to avert catastrophe. So at what point and in what form this will catch up with us, no one could say, but it is going to happen.
In your darker moments, do you ever wonder whether the industrial adventure was a one-shot deal?
Well, I think every civilization, I've been reading about past civilizations, which I find very interesting, including the unbelievably successful pre-Columbian civilizations in South and in Mesoamerica. Reading Charles Mann's book, 1491, it's clear that many previous civilizations, many of them, Rome, established, may not call it industrial, but for their own time, highly developed, elaborate semi-industrial enterprises that sustain very large and impressive civilizations over centuries, but they all collapsed. And I think that could happen to our civilization because we are consuming resources at an unsustainable rate. And every time that's happened in the past, you have civilizational collapse, and there's no reason why that can't happen again.
And of course, the scale of our consumption of resources is light years and orders of magnitude above what these earlier civilizations were consuming and using.
Yes, that's true. But there's no difference in the basic equation, which was for their own environment and their habitats, they were engaging in the same level of hyper-consumption and hyper-resource exploitation that we are engaged in today. So our ability to extract things from the earth is greater than ever before. But the underlying process of exceeding the capacity of our environment is leading to collapse, that basic equation remains unchanged.
Well, one of the things that you certainly have written about a lot is the depletion of resources other than oil, and especially the metal ores and things that we depend on of that nature.
Right. And I do believe that this is all part of a larger picture of wholesale depletion of the world's currently existing reserves of vital resources, minerals, land for growing food, water, virtually everything we need. We're now exploiting what's in existence, what's in production or available to us to the max, and we're using it up very rapidly. So there's a race on, that's what the title of my new book, The Race for What's Left, to discover and to exploit those last remaining resources, like in the Arctic and Siberia and deep under the oceans. But there isn't enough in those places to replace what we're using up now. So we are faced for a very difficult future unless we develop a new economic model based on renewable materials.
I've had a pet theory that I've run by a number of people on my podcast, and that is about Japan. And my pet theory is that they will be the first advanced industrial nation to go medieval because they have no fossil fuels of their own, and they lack a lot of basic resources.
Mm.
Although lately, I must say, I wonder whether they will go medieval or just end up being a depopulated, smoldering heap of steaming radioactive kelp.
Yes, well, those scenarios are plausible. I don't know if it'll be Japan that's first. That's an interesting question for speculation. What I see in medieval, neo-medieval terms is what I was hinting at earlier, is the disintegration of large states into smaller countries because the center can't hold. China, Indonesia, India, eventually the United States, breaking up into smaller entities, some of which may be able to sustain a comfortable standard of living like what we have now, but many of them degenerating into third world countries.
Well, one of the implications of what you're saying is an inability or a loss of ability to project power as far as it can be projected now.
I think we're seeing that for sure. The ability of any country to maintain a global military presence is vanishing very rapidly. And even the ability of large continental states like Russia, Indonesia, India, China, to maintain a high level of control over all of their disparate provinces and regions, many with ethnic minorities that are in revolt, that's also diminishing.
Well, how do you see the condition of the world in 20 years from now, let's say? And in particular, how do you see the United States 20 years from now? Both in terms of how we're doing just on our own and our relation to the other nations of the world.
Again, we have a lot of fun discussing that, Jim. I see the state of the world, one in which there will remain pockets of wealth and prosperity in relative terms. Those places, I think, tend to be places that have a lot of water. Because water, we didn't talk about water yet, but water is going to be a big determinant in all of this, a big variable.
Yeah, is Canada going to rule the world? Because when you actually look at the map of Canada, about half of the landmass seems to be water.
Yes. Well, I think if I were the Canadians, I would be wondering about the day when we're going to talk about the United States of America and Canada.
Yeah.
I've wondered myself
whether the United States might invoke the Monroe Doctrine at some point and prevent Canada from trading with other nations outside the Western Hemisphere for their oil.
I easily find that imaginable. Not to mention other ways of forcing Canada under NAFTA to sell its water to the United States. Things like that happening. So, like I say, I think there will be parts of the world that will remain relatively prosperous and maintain what we would consider a modern civilization, Scandinavia, Switzerland, who knows where else. But a lot of the rest of the world I see being in much worse shape in the years ahead, and a greater medievalism in the sense of after the Roman Empire broke up, you had all these local dukes and duchies and small kingdoms all fighting amongst themselves for resources from behind walls.
Is the breakup of the United States plausible? You mentioned that China was a candidate for possibly breaking up into conflicting regions. How about the USA?
I think there's no reason to say that that couldn't happen in the future. I don't think it would happen in the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. But over the long term, as climate change becomes more advanced, I see no reason why that couldn't happen.
Well, yeah, Dixieland might be uninhabitable for one thing.
Well, certainly the Southwest.
Yeah, and certainly the Southwest.
And those people are going to want to move. And, you know, the places they're going to want to move to are places with water, which is the Pacific Northwest and New England, upstate New York. And the question is, how receptive will the populations of those areas be to massive migrations of Americans, but from those other areas, whether they're going to open their arms? And I'm not sure.
Well, let me ask you one more question. You live in an area around Amherst, Massachusetts, which is kind of a hotbed of education and thinking people. There are a lot of colleges there. It's you know, kind of what people think about when they think about the northeastern, pointy-headed, liberal intellectuals, right?
Yes.
How do you find your friends and neighbors in that part of the world? What is their comprehension of the predicaments that we're facing?
There are a lot of us who, like you and I are talking, will talk along the same lines. And there is a growing fervor for developing sustainable ways of life and implementing them. For example, the colleges that I work for, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, Amherst, UMass, are making vast efforts to, let's say, greenify the physical plant, the energy system, the food system, to become more self-sustaining, more reliant. And so there's a lot you could say that's very promising that's going on. My concern is that, you know, we're relatively blessed here in New England with water and land and climate. But how replicable are these attempts that we're making here in this very favorable, benign environment? Can this be duplicated on a very large scale in the rest of the country and the rest of the world? About that, I have some doubts.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thank you very much for talking to me.
And it's been my pleasure.
Okie dokie. We will ride again, Michael.
Okay. Bye, Jim. Take care.
You've been listening to The ConcertCast featuring James Howard Kunstler. Send email to jim@concertcast.com. You can interact with other listeners, hear previous episodes, and find out more about this podcast at concertcast.com.